From WNYC, New York Public Radio, this is the podcast of The Leonard Lopate Show, and I'm Leonard Lopate. This is just one segment of today's show. The rest of today's show is available for download and on-demand listening at WNYC.org. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners. Please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org.
WNYC podcasts are supported by Holy Name Hospital in Teaneck, New Jersey, providing comprehensive centers in cardiovascular services, interventional radiology, and cancer care. More information at www.holyname.org. You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
And it's underreported. On today's Underreported, the focus is on climate change and some of its lesser-known consequences, like exploding beetle populations in the West and its financial risks to big businesses and government. I'm pleased to welcome Dr. Paul Epstein from the Center for Health and Global Environment, Dr. Gavin Schmidt from NASA Goddard Institute for Space Studies, and Adam Aston of Business Week to my show today. Hello.
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 Good afternoon. Paul Epstein here.
2005 was the warmest year on record in the Northern Hemisphere, the second warmest globally since the 1860s when reliable records began. Can that all just be part of the cyclical nature of weather, or does it mean global warming is already here, Gavin?
Global warming is already here. The changes that we've seen can't be explained by any kinds of natural forcing or internal variability in the oceans or anything like that. We've been able to eliminate 99% of the other possibilities. And the one that remains is that the climate is changing through human interference with things like greenhouse gas concentrations, aerosols, particles in the atmosphere, and changes in land use and things like that.
And Paul, would all scientists agree on that?
Well, to reinforce what Gavin has just said, what the missing element has been the warming in the deep ocean. And we got a hint of this in 1994 with just a transect across the Atlantic that there was warming down to 2 miles. The bottom is 4 miles. But in 2000, Sid Levitas and his colleagues at NOAA, this is our Department of Commerce, concluded that all the oceans were warming down deep, the Indian Pacific, the Atlantic, and around both poles. And just this past year, Tim Barnett and his colleagues at Scripps Institution for Oceanography concluded that 84% of the last century's warming was in the deep oceans. It's actually warmed 22 times as much as the atmosphere, and that the pattern that one sees is unmistakably attributable to greenhouse gases and human activities.
Well, then, Gavin, how do we distinguish between what's global warming and what's just a part of Earth's up and down cycles?
That's a very good question.
There is a fossil record, isn't there?
Right. I mean, there are paleo records. These are often in kind of difficult to interpret archives like the ice sheets in Greenland or in tree rings or in the ocean mud. And it takes a very special kind of scientist to really want to dig around in that, some of that mud. those stories that are coming out of there are absolutely fascinating. And the changes that the climate can undergo, particularly during the ice ages, are really almost terrifying to contemplate. Things happened very, very quick in those days. And we understand from the paleo record quite how sensitive some of the aspects of the climate are. Now, when you go back, the causes of those changes were very different to the causes of the changes that we're seeing now. They relate to changes in the orbit of the Earth, how much it wobbles, how circular the orbit is. And those changes happen on relatively slow timescales. And you can see that envelope going back millions of years. But as everything is changing, the climate will suddenly flip and it will change very rapidly to a new state that's kind of more in tune with what the situation, where it wants to be. And those kinds of things over the last 10 years have become a really big part of the studying of climate, to try and work out exactly what those points are and what those mechanisms are.
Adam, since believe me, I'll let you talk, Dr. Epstein. Adam, since scientists all seem to agree, pretty much the only ones who don't are from the business community, or is that changing as well?
It's changing, and by region. If your reality is America, I'd say that's a reasonable thing to say, in that it's changing, for one thing, and that there is a little bit of ambivalence to resistance in the business community. What's important to remember, though, is if you fly to London or Europe or even in Asia, pretty practically anywhere there, you'll find a much higher sensibility about it and a concern. That has to do with, a public political pressure. Green movements in Europe are much more evolved and significant there. But they've also been experiencing the kind of severe weather we have, and I think are a little bit more, say, at a popular level, kind of willing to attach the two things. And governments there have taken a leadership position in kind of helping the population understand and work with, the Kyoto Protocol Accords and some different rules and ways to respond by buying green energy and that kind of thing. It's a lot more difficult here without any leadership.
Well, there's an IPCC, isn't there?
Mm-hmm.
What is that, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change?
I would, Gavin, you might have more to say about that than I do. I understand that's a sort of advisory board of experts from all of the signatories to the Kyoto Protocol.
Actually, it's much more widespread than that. The IPCC was set up to really give policymakers a clear understanding of what we knew, how we knew it, and what the uncertainties and where the problems still were. And it did that by gathering information from the scientific literature, passing it through peer review, writing summaries. And the idea is to produce an assessment that is relatively conservative. It's not like one person out on the limb screaming that the sky is falling. It's the consensus that pretty much the vast bulk of the climate community can agree on. And the fact that we can agree on anything in the academic or scientific world is really quite amazing. And the fact that they've been able to agree very clearly that 3 or 4 years ago that there was a discernible influence of human activity on the climate. There's a new report that's being prepared as we speak that will be coming out in February 2007. Pretty much everything since the 2001 report has confirmed what we thought, and so it's probably going to be a slightly stronger statement that time.
We're talking about the lesser-known consequences of global warming with Dr. Gavin Schmidt from NASA Goddard Institute for Space Studies, Adam Aston of Business Week, and Dr. Paul Epstein from the Center for Health and the Global Environment. You wanted to say something, Dr. Epstein?
Sure, thank you. This is excellent. Just sort of to reverberate back to what Gavin was saying in terms of where the orbits and the orbital changes, the tilts, the wobbles, and so on, help explain most of everything that we know about climate throughout the history of the planet until we get to the 20th century. And there, one can only explain the actual data by including the greenhouse gases.
What about the impact on the public? For example, the deadly heat wave in Europe 3 years ago, most people think that is part of global warming, and that must have affected a lot of people in Europe.
Well, it certainly did, and this is what we're seeing in terms of cascading effects of the impacts, and that works back into the Adam's comments about the finances. The heat wave in 2003 was an extraordinary event. If one thinks in probabilities, it was actually 6 standard deviations away from the mean. There were 21,000 to 35,000 deaths. Beyond that, there were wildfires and forest loss. There was shutdown of nuclear power plants because the water was so warm. Livestock and crops were lost, and 10% of the Alps were actually lost, and that's about 5 times what it's been shrinking. So what we're seeing is enormous costs, and what's interesting about the financial economic discussion is one might think of finance as the central nervous system of the global economy, and it's feeling and sensing the pain, and it can also act on the motor side, as it were, and work on the solutions. So I think we'll come back to the opportunities. But in the 1960s, 70s, and 80s, there were about $4 billion lost to natural catastrophes. That jumped up in the 90s to $40 billion a year, tenfold. 2004, it was about $140 billion. Last year, with Katrina and Wilma and Rita, it was about $230 billion. And the percentage of insured losses went from about 10% in the earlier period to 30%. So the insurance companies, the reinsurers, the banks, the pension funds, the financial dimensions are really beginning to understand the risks, and they also represent an armada of billions and trillions that could shift assets into the solutions.
So, Adam, are insurance companies and reinsurers deviating from the rest of the business community here, where business concerns are given as the reason for loosening environmental restrictions?
Yeah, well, just to elaborate on what Paul explained so well there, they are kind of a leading edge of sensitivity to this, because one sort of the inner workings of the insurance industry is important to understand. When you and I buy insurance, those insurance companies actually usually group together a lot of policies and then sell them on or move them on to what are called reinsurance companies. This is their companies, usually the largest ones are in Europe, Swiss Re, Munich Re. And so they collect risk. In other words, they hold many, many housing insurance policies, many health policies, that kind of thing. And so they see across much larger numbers, much larger samples of events, what's coming. And that gets to Paul's point about the rising cost of damages. We saw it locally, of course, in New Orleans and the series of increased hurricane losses in this hurricane cycle in Florida. We're seeing year upon year of losses that are multiples of what the historical record has shown. Insurance companies ultimately are responsible to pay out for that, and one of their interests, of course, is being able to, if they can predict that, then they can pay for it. They can charge premium, they can adjust their portfolios, they can make plans for it. But what I think has scared them, and they've been seeing it if you talk to them for decades now, is that their ability to predict that, to forecast, to know what to expect financially has been kind of off the mark. It's going up faster than they expect, and it's a kind of a financial mirror of the climate change itself, in that when they see whole cities wiped out, or as Paul was explaining in Europe, the disruption of business is another example that's much less dramatic. You don't see houses swamped and homeless people kind of gathered in masses, but power plants, when they can't produce power because of either droughts in the Northwest. This has happened last 2 years in the Pacific Northwest in the U.S., where water flows due to low snowpack in the mountains to the east of the Washington and Portland areas were too low to drive the generators. In other cases, as Paul mentioned, the water can actually get too warm to perform the role it needs to in certain kinds of generators.
So we have to be a little bit careful on the attribution question.
Sure. Mm.
Every time there's something a little bit odd that goes on in the weather, and it can be very serious, I've been invited on CNN, and the question they always ask me is, oh, was that global warming? And I have to explain the difference between natural weather variability, the fact that, this winter was extremely warm in the United States, but that was matched by an extremely cold winter in Russia and in Europe. And those kinds of things are much, much harder to attribute to climate change than, say, the statistics of the global mean temperature. And so when you talk about the connection of the admittedly, extremely large increases in damage estimates and insured losses that we've seen over the last few decades, some of that may be attributable to climate change, but a lot of it is still attributable to increased coastal development, population movements to much more vulnerable areas. If you look at the flood damage in East and Western Europe, for instance, in Western Europe, where there's been a lot more building on floodplains, the flood damages were much higher than in Eastern Europe, where people still hadn't been building there. And so those factors, You need to take that context.
They make it more difficult also to make predictions, scientific
Absolutely.
Predictions. We have to take a little break. We'll come back. I know all of you want to talk. I can hear it. My guests are Dr. Gavin Schmidt from NASA Goddard Institute for Space Studies, Adam Aston of Business Week, and Dr. Paul Epstein from the Center for Health and Global Environment. Stay with us. We're back with Underreported, and my guests are Dr. Paul Epstein from the Center for Health and Global Environment, Dr. Gavin Schmidt from NASA Goddard Institute for Space Studies, and Adam Aston of Business Week. Dr. Epstein, recent reports have warned that one of the worst waves of extinction since the dinosaurs is on its way for exotic frogs and toads in Latin America. How significant are those extinctions?
If I might just reinforce what Gavin just said, and just to keep that, because the way he put it, I think, is excellent. One can think of four reasons for why the financial costs are rising. Populations are moving towards the coast, real estate prices have gone up, and there's increased insurance penetration, and there are more intense events. And this is one, it's not an either or, it's an and these are compounding issues. And as climate changes, we may see it become a more dominant force. One has to see the natural variability and climate change as interacting and perhaps exaggerating the natural variability. How we look at that and how we understand it goes back to the issue of the deep ocean, and it's really the deep ocean warming that drives the hurricane. The Katrina is the surface, but it's the warm water under it that replenishes it, that gets you Rita, Wilma, etc. So we've got a plausible mechanism, and it's this heat that's built up that really has been in the miscalculations of the intense storms. Now, getting to the biological diversity issues that are related to climate, we've just had a study come out in Science this past week about the whole shift in the marine system in the Arctic and how very plankton and predators and fish are moving north, and it's changing the whole dynamics among predators and prey, and of course that means who eats whom and so on.
And they're moving north to get to cooler waters?
They're moving north because the waters are warming. We are seeing changes in the land that are more vegetation, which incidentally has two dimensions. You've got retreat of ice, which means more heat is absorbed on the land. We call that albedo, the reflectivity, and we're seeing that as ice retreats on the water, more heat is going to the ocean. So we've got what we call positive feedbacks. They're not good, but they reinforce the warming both on land and water, and it's affecting the biological systems. Right here in New England, and we've seen in the Northeast incredible variability. Between January 1st and the middle of February, the changes of 10 degrees from one day to the next occurred 18 times. The usual is 10 to 12. This affects freeze-thaw cycles. We saw crocuses in D.C. We've seen plants coming up. We're concerned that that's going to affect plants and food security. It's going to plant predators and prey. We may not be there yet, but if this kind of variability increases across all scales, it is particularly damaging to the ecological balances that are predators and prey and competitors and nitrogen fixers and so on, and pollinators that are so key to the emerging infectious disease and food security issues.
But let's get to those frog extinctions, because we've been hearing about them for
sure.
A while. Do they pose an immediate danger for humans, or are they kind of the canary in the mine story?
Again, it's multiple issues, and that's what's important. It may be UVB, ultraviolet, it's changing habitat. But we've seen a clear case in Costa Rica where the shift of the cloud cover up to higher altitudes because of warming appears to have affected one toad that's gone extinct. And so, again, it's climate change that and climate variability and increased variability that may play a role on species that are marginal in the first place. Now, these frogs, well, they're a canary, but they also control mosquitoes. Birds eat mosquitoes. So there are cascading implications of losing species for those that can become pests and carriers of pathogens or agents of disease.
Gavin, there has been a mountain pine beetle infestation in Canada. Is that something we can tie to climate change? And does that pose a real threat to forests?
Well, one of the things that you get as the climate changes is it's very difficult to say that, you know, one climate is better or worse than another climate. But as things change, some things are able to move faster to adapt to a new region or to move further north or to move up to a higher altitude faster than other parts of that ecosystem. So, for instance, trees are very slow to move. But beetles, they move quite quickly. And so as ecosystem boundaries shift, what goes first are generally the pests. And they can often move into environments where before they weren't viable. And so in Alaska and in Canada, these beetles have moved in, and they would be they wouldn't have been able to survive the harsh winters that of yore, but now they're able to survive a little bit easier. And so they're encroaching on terrain where they never lived before, and there are no natural predators for them.
And Adam, they're posing a real problem for the logging industry, aren't they?
Yeah, I mean, these are great examples. I think the beetles in particular, it's one I've not studied closely, but I have read in Paul's work and some other places some of the questions about how food production can be affected by these shifts. That has a lot to do with temperature, of course. The plain states where we grow most of our cereal crops, corn, wheat, etc., are not the most climatologically hospitable places. They are engineered, basically, by man with irrigation and fertilizers to produce a bounty of food for us. It wouldn't take a dramatic increase in average temperature to seriously affect the productivity of those areas. And take that, one of the most advanced food production areas in the world, and, you know, multiply that across all of the other places in the world where we already see in Africa what has been characterized as a temporary drought for many years. In the Darfur and sub-Saharan areas is being recognized increasingly as a permanent shift in higher temperatures and decreased rainfall. There are huge implications on the food side, which is obviously a business issue, but also a real security issue. It can dislocate people who are looking for food. It can cause wars, as you might characterize the Darfur issue as well. So for agricultural goods, wood, food, et cetera, there are a lot of questions, and as we've been alluding to, I think consistently, it's hard to predict exactly how and when it will happen. A lot of the changes we're talking about right now, I think, are really notable because they happen so far from humans' presence that they're multiplying now. We can look at the poles, we can look at the high mountains, we can look at under the oceans and coral areas. These all tend to be at the periphery of human experience. And so it's a little bit easier for us to ignore the incidences right now, but I think that as they multiply and come literally physically closer to mankind's footprint, basically, that they'll become more noticed, and I think the alarm will kind of get louder.
We're talking about the lesser-known consequences that may be attributed to global warming with Adam Aston of Business Week, Dr. Gavin Schmidt of NASA Goddard Institute for Space Studies, and Dr. Paul Epstein from the Center for Health and Global Environment. This is WNYC 93.9 AM 820. We're online at WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. So is climate change having an impact on the energy sector? A recent study about how warmer temperatures in Alaska are melting tundra and causing problems for oil pipelines and power transmission lines.
This is a very crucial question. I'm always one step behind here, but the beetle story that Adam and Gavin were talking about is so crucial because from Arizona to Alaska, we're seeing these beetles, and one can see, again, compounding issues because prolonged drought has affected some of the pine trees, and it's the rosin in the trees that dries the beetles as they try to bore through the bark, and then the beetles themselves are getting emboldened, going to higher altitudes, latitudes, new sneaking in an extra generation a year and overwintering. So it's, again, compounding, but your energy question is very crucial. We are seeing, clearly, we saw in the Gulf storms, this last storm, 167 of the 4,000 oil rigs went down because of storms. We're seeing melting in the tundra that's affecting the pipes and the integrity of the pipelines. We're seeing blackouts because of heat waves. We're seeing shutdown of plants because of warming of water. We're seeing things like in Peru where they're losing their water supply and hydropower because melting glaciers, that they're planning coal-fired plants to replace them, which, of course, fossil fuels could contribute to the problem. And finally, deforestation is driven by many things, but one of the main things is energy use. So as we need energy becomes fundamental to driving the deforestation. So the energy sector itself is very vulnerable to climate change and to intense storms that are accompanying it. And this is an underreported event, as you have in your title.
And I assume, Adam, it's also having an impact on tourism, where places that once were really pleasant to visit or had interesting things happening now are going through change.
Well, yeah, I think the most dramatic example of that is one that is often cited as literally the loss of sort of mankind's presence on Earth, which would be the coral atolls in the Indian Ocean and Pacific, which on average are just, a foot or two above sea level. And to be clear, and Paul and Gavin both are probably more informed about this, the amount of water level rise that's happened now and what's predicted is truly incremental and gradual, but it doesn't matter whether it's centimeters in a year or so. The surge that can happen in any given set of storms can, as we saw in a series of hurricanes, it doesn't necessarily submerge these islands, it just makes them persistently hostile places to be. But in time, if predictions are correct, it's not just that, but they'll be underwater. So, whether it's the Maldives and other diving paradises, the Australian coral reef, the Great Barrier Reef I think it's an international heritage site, and it's suffering from higher water temperatures, more acidic water. It's called coral bleaching, so that areas of active, healthy coral are basically retreating into less polluted and cooler waters, and overall that just diminishes the amount of coral and plant life in a coral area. So skiing is probably another example in the tourism space, anywhere where you need a kind of a delicate set of climatic conditions to enjoy. You get more variability and thus less dependability in the kinds of conditions that tourists can expect.
Gavin, do you think that this is a really underreported story? Your boss is Jim Hansen, who made headlines in December because of his struggles with the public affairs people at NASA, who didn't want his data to be released.
Jim wasn't underreported last month.
Was underreported before he went public.
The issue with the public affairs office at NASA was that they were really, that any discussion of climate to them was a political statement. And as scientists, we find that very odd because, we just want people to understand what it is that we've found out, and we want people to, to see why it is that we think the way we do and to be informed. Jim and the group, I work as part of his group. We've been working on projections for the future. We've been working on trying to understand what's happened in the past, and those are stories that really ought to be out there. It's not that we're demanding front page attention. This only became a front page story because of rather clumsy efforts to keep it off even the back page.
But isn't it a front page story? Some of the things we've been talking about, and there are more, the For example, Paul's organization focuses on how changes in the environment relate to public health, and that we've discussed floods, but also diseases. West Nile related to environmental issues, malaria, asthma.
Right.
And if climate change starts exacerbating some of these things.
Absolutely. I mean, these are important issues, and the thing about climate change is that it's not an environmental cause du jour. It's not going to go away tomorrow because it doesn't get any more publicity. It's a long-term issue, and the solutions, if there are to be solutions, need to be thought of well in advance.
Well, let me ask Paul whether he thinks that capitalism can do this, or whether it's going to take a major, an awful lot of governmental attitude changing.
Well, we've clearly gone towards privatization and deregulation. I do think we're going to move towards public support for the infrastructure to provide the incentives for business to move ahead, and we're going to need some new regulations and standards and rules to constrain the behavior. I think the real underestimated story, an underreported story, is that the solutions are about job creation. We can drive the economy with clean energy, energy efficiency, distributed forms, green buildings, rooftop gardens, bike lanes, walking lanes, all these smart technologies that make the grid more secure. These can provide the engine of growth for this 21st
century. Are you suggesting we can reverse this?
I'm suggesting that we have to move ahead quickly.
You're shaking your head no, Gavin. You don't think we can reverse it. Is this irrevocable now?
Okay.
No.
I mean, this is a very good point. People tend to sometimes have a fatalistic attitude about this issue because it is long-term, and the energy infrastructure that would need to turn around is a very big ship indeed. The reason for action now would be that the decisions being made now are going to control our emissions in 30 and 50 years' time. By the time that comes around and we see some of the changes that are projected, it may be a little bit too late to avoid the really dangerous things. And the really dangerous things revolve around very large rises in sea level. And one of the reasons why we're monitoring the ice sheets in Greenland and Antarctica to the degree that we are is because people recognize that the amount of coastal infrastructure everywhere in the world and the millions of people that live within a few meters of sea level would be an absolutely devastating thing. And so to avoid that is something that may be necessary to have action to do. But there is still going to be climate change that's going to continue pretty much regardless of what we do. It's just moderating that amount.
But maybe we should buy some waterfront property in Cincinnati.
Well, I agree, and I think we have to find stabilization wedges these days, the solutions that provide the best way to adapt and mitigate, to adapt and prevent further change, and things like distributed forms of generation of energy with geothermal and tidal and wind and solar can provide security in the face of storms and heat waves and also help drive the markets for these new technologies.
We have to end it here, unfortunately, but my great thanks to you all, Dr. Paul Epstein from the Center for Health and the Global Environment, Dr. Gavin Schmidt from NASA Goddard Institute for Space Studies, and Adam Aston of Business Week. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Leonard.
Thanks for listening to today's podcast of The Leonard Lopate Show from WNYC, New York Public Radio. This was just one of the show's segments. You can hear everything we do on demand at WNYC.org. Check out our other podcasts at WNYC.org or on iTunes. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners. Please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org. And thanks.